Bom dia. Eu sou Ana Luísa Gomes e falo aqui pela Comissão Organizadora, Técnica e Científica deste quarto encontro. Reafirmo que não medimos esforços em proporcionar um ambiente acolhedor, respeitoso e também carinhoso. Para isso, queremos dividir com todos vocês algumas informações que vão facilitar nossa convivência e entrosamento nesses dias de evento. Primeiro, que cuidaremos da pontualidade. Segundo, todas as palestras serão gravadas e com tradução simultânea. E até em função disso, pedimos a gentileza de que as falas de todos sejam um pouco mais lentas e compassadas para facilitar o trabalho dos tradutores. Para toda e qualquer informação que precisarem, procurem a Clementina. A nossa equipe de apoio está timbrada com a imagem desta musa brasileira e à disposição para ajudar na localização dos espaços, nos horários das atividades, questões de inscrição, refeições, transportes e deslocamentos. Tem alguma Clementina na área? A mesa desta manhã tem como tema o estado da arte dos cuidados paliativos. E a mediadora é a doutora Amira Adnan Salman, médica fisiatra, consultora educacional do Hospital Premier e facilitadora do programa Kelka Premier 2019, e a quem eu tenho a alegria de chamar aqui para o palco. Na dinâmica que preparamos, após a apresentação de cada um dos nossos três convidados desta mesa, teremos um momento cultural cuidadosamente concebido para aquecer as nossas almas, e depois um intervalo de meia hora antes de retornarmos à fase de perguntas da plateia. Tenhamos todos um bom dia de trabalho. Amira, a casa é sua.
Obrigada, Ana. Bom dia a todos. Temos muito trabalho pela frente. Temos uma longa jornada até que possamos diminuir as desigualdades no acesso aos cuidados paliativos. A primeira mesa redonda do dia nos trará um panorama dos cuidados paliativos no Reino Unido, na América Latina e no Brasil, para que possamos nos inspirar com aquilo que já foi alcançado, mas, principalmente, nos empoderar daquilo que ainda precisa ser feito. Em nome da comissão organizadora e complementando a fala do Dr. Samir, eu gostaria de dizer que nós acreditamos muito no poder dessa força colaborativa, dessa interação entre os profissionais aqui presentes, para a construção e para a elaboração, o fortalecimento das boas práticas de cuidado. Eu me sinto muito honrada em anunciar a primeira apresentação do dia, que ilustrará como St. Christopher Hospice está respondendo aos desafios contemporâneos e como esses desafios se assemelham aos desafios globais. Convido Liz Bryan. Liz Bryan tem formação em enfermagem de cuidados paliativos, psicoterapia de aconselhamento, educação interprofissional e avaliação educacional. Durante 12 anos, ela lecionou em período parcial na Faculdade de Enfermagem e Obstetrícia Florence Nightingale no King's College London, apoiando a prestação de educação acadêmica baseada em evidências paliativas e no final de vida. Esse é um papel que ela renunciou para se concentrar em tempo integral na liderança como diretora de educação e treinamento do St. Christopher's Hospice, no design do edifício e conceito do Learning Hub. Agora, como consultora de educação, Liz está comprometida em impulsionar o desenvolvimento local, nacional e internacional de cuidados paliativos e culturalmente apropriados ao fim de vida. Seu foco particular é avaliar programas de aprendizado que tenham impacto na prática. A enfermeira projetou o programa Kelka, que agora está sendo entregue por instituições satélites no Reino Unido e no exterior. Sou muito honrada de convidar agora Liz Bryan.
So, good morning. My name's Liz Bryan. I'm a nurse, primarily, psychotherapist, and now full-time educationalist. and it's a great honor to be here in São Paulo. I'm actually going to talk this morning about the modifications, quite radical in many ways, that are occurring at St. Christopher's in South London. Generally recognised as the founding hospice of the modern hospice movement, but now facing many challenges. And I was, I think, reminded by Sammy that we also have a two-part system in the UK. We have a national health system, which is very effective. It has been certainly very effective in the first 50 years since it was developed and introduced into the UK. But it's no longer fit for purpose because the burden on our national health service is so great that we are having to rethink how we deliver health and social care. And it is supplemented by the private and the voluntary sector, probably more the voluntary sector. And I think it's important to remind you that the 220 hospices that we have in the UK are almost all charities. They're voluntary organisations, which means that care continues to be free at the point of delivery. So there's no difference for hospice patients than there is for NHS patients. But we have to work very hard to raise the funding for those voluntary sector hospices. But even they can't now manage the full volume of those that need palliative care. So we do need to think, what models do we need now in the UK and the world? And what I think for us is very important is that St. Christopher's, we're 50 years old, we're just over 50 years old. We want to share our learning so other countries and other organisations don't have to go through the same mistakes and pain that we have. So an outline of my presentation is really around highlighting the concerns of the UK government regarding end-of-life care and the action most recently they've taken. The role of hospices and obviously in particular St. Christopher's, because that's the hospice I know the most about and it is the largest hospice in the UK and is generally seen as the lead. And what Quelca, the programme that we've developed in recent years, is how it's supporting those changes. It's an example, I think, of our approach to education. So what challenges do we face in the UK? Now, I'm going to try and do something whizzy-bang hit now and see if I can get you straight through to a publication which talks about ageing in the UK. Wish me luck. It's somewhat alarming to think that if you were born in 2013, you have a 1 in 3 chance of living to 100. Those are the figures in the UK. Now, as we all know, when you live longer, you don't get more youth. You get more old age. And with old age, we get aches and pains and things are maybe not quite so easily functioning. I often talk to my students about the moment I realised that when I plucked my eyebrows, I had to put the skin back. It's a bit of a salutary moment when you realise that, yes, that old person in the mirror is you. But without exaggerating, I'm in my 60s, I have to recognise that I need to be making provision for my old age. I need to be realistic about what comorbidities I'm likely to experience because of family histories, etc. What my quality of life might be. How I can enhance my quality of life by making sure that I live on a level. You'd laugh if you saw my house because it's like that. So clearly I need to do something about that. But I'd be, like everyone else, reluctant to admit I can't manage until the last moment. Notice that women will still live longer than men. Very interesting. But the reasons for better survival are the fact that less people are smoking, that the medical interventions for heart disease are so much more improved, and cancer treatments. So cancer is now increasingly becoming a chronic condition, which is very different from 50 years ago. And generally, we're more aware of the role diet plays in our lives. Medicalization of dying. We have made it, and I think this, if Cicely Saunders was here now, the founder of St. Christopher's, she would also accept that in her effort to involve doctors in dying, we probably swung far too far in the other direction, so that now people really feel that they have to have a physician involved when they come to the end of their lives. And we know that actually many people have or could have potentially natural deaths. If they do need medical intervention, they don't necessarily need palliative care. They may need a palliative care approach, but they might not need hospice or specialist palliative care. So it's really important for us to think about what are the skills and understanding and knowledge that the generalists in our healthcare systems need to know so they can support aging and dying, but also how they involve our communities, society, and the whole of our communities in that whole support. We have economic constraints, which I have already mentioned. We have a really stretched system in the UK. We have austerity measures. We have, as you probably gathered, political crisis at the moment in the UK. And these things will impact on our healthcare system. What we do have, though, is our public support of a national health service. So I think ultimately it will be put to the people as to whether we would like to make greater contribution financially, because actually it's not a free system. Everyone who's employed contributes to our national health system. We have a shortage of nurses. Nursing in the UK is less popular, partly I think because of a crisis in identity. Nursing has, in its effort to become professionalized and academic, nurses have moved further and further away from the actual patient care. And that's caused some confusion around our identity. What is nursing for? What is it about? Is it a discipline or is it a role? And those are interesting debates that I'm having all over the world with other nurses. And we have a need for new models of care, which I've talked about. So what has the government done to address all these issues? Well, we've had many different publications, starting with the National End of Life Care Strategy in 2008, with loads and loads of different other additional guidelines, policies, all of which were saying the same thing, but actually really weren't making much of a difference. We all agree that we need better palliative and end-of-life care, but how you deliver that is the biggest challenge. But this is the latest of a number of resources. It's called Ambitions, and it very firmly puts the person in the center of any innovations and developments. So the main ambition is, and I'll read it, and it's very much in the first person, I can make the last stage of my life as good as possible because everyone works together confidently, honestly, and consistently to help me and the people who are important to me, including my carers. So that's the ambition, and this is seen as a framework for local partners to work together to deliver good palliative and end-of-life care. So that by that, it'll be in regions. We have things called clinical commissioning groups, which are geographic, and the encouragement here is that partners work collaboratively to find the best way to put the patient in the centre. And there are six ambitions there, which are named. Each person is seen as an individual, each person gets fair access to care, maximising comfort and well-being, care is coordinated, all staff are prepared to care, each community is prepared to care. And I'll come back certainly to five and six. So, the role of hospices, palliative care providers. So it's important, I think, to distinguish between hospices, which I've explained are generally voluntary sector organisations, charities. Palliative care teams within hospitals will be state funded. So they hospital palliative care teams work within the NHS. But they often work very collaboratively with the hospice. So on discharge from hospitals, they'll be handing over the patient to the local hospice, if there is one locally. Now, what are our key messages? These very much relate to St. Christopher's, but the first one is, and this is not rocket science, and you'll go, oh my goodness, has she flown all the way from London to tell us this? Death is essentially a social experience with health-related consequences. Thinking about how to live and die well is a societal issue. And it feels to me, I feel I've got more used to it, but a few years ago I felt like death and dying have been dumped on us as professionals to sort out. And actually, we need to recognise that we have to share this responsibility with society. We are society. We're going to die. Anyone in the room not going to die? Effective palliative care requires investment at several levels. And again, Dr. Smear mentioned this. The wider systems of care. We have to invest in looking at how systems work. Do they enhance care or do they hinder care? And for many of us, we're frustrated continuously with coming against aspects of systems that really don't help us to provide compassionate, person-centred care. The organisations providing care for people at the end of life. So in the UK, we are getting quite frustrated as voluntary sector organisations that are struggling to bring in the income that actually the government is not working more closely in supporting or at least providing something towards the cost of our services. Give you just a little bit of an example. It costs £21 million a year to run St. Christopher's. We get £6 million from the government, so that's through local commissioning of services. We have to raise the rest of that through fundraising. Some of that will be local people having bring and buy sales, cake sales, jumping out of aeroplanes, doing sponsored walks, etc. But that's only a very, very small proportion of our income. The rest is fundraising through trusts, national corporations, foundations, legacies, so people leaving money in their wills. It's a huge area of work in order to provide the services that we do. But it does give us autonomy. And that would be one of the messages I would have, certainly for Brazil, is just think about developing some voluntary sector services that you then have control over. The problem with always getting money from the state is that you then have targets to meet and boxes to tick and data to provide, which is quite right, but sometimes those conflict with the philosophy of the hospice. And we need to invest in the communities in which people live and die. So good end-of-life care is not just about buildings and professionals, it's actually about our whole communities. And as I say, high-quality palliative care draws in community action alongside professional care. And I've already been impressed by walking around Premier at how fundamental to the life of Premier here is the community, how involved the community are or encouraged to be. So we want a society in which citizens help each other. This is a sort of breast cancer rally. We were talking last night about suffering, and we're very interested in the whole subject of, you know, what does suffering, how is it experienced in today's society? You know, how we perceive suffering. Are we less tolerant of suffering? And how are we supporting one another to transition through those life stages that can be so painful? Not just dying, but... So where death is seen as part of life, where planning for end of life is the norm, wouldn't that be wonderful if we all started thinking in our adult years about our aging, our old age, and what that might look like, and what we would want if we became dependent? We want a world in which citizens feel confident to support their families, friends, and neighbours in times of serious illness or bereavement. And fundamentally, and I think this is really important, we want a world where medicine and healthcare can focus on doing what it's best at, which is redressing challenging clinical problems. So our focus needs to be on when we really are needed, but then making sure that there's a much more effective public health model and that people start taking responsibility back. So what does that look like at St. Christopher's? Well, we've just worked, we have a care transition team that have been working over the last year, 18 months, really debating what St. Christopher's services should look like. And we have decided that we really should, so that top part of the pyramid, we should only be giving direct care and support to a small minority in our population, those that have got the really complex and unpredictable symptoms. However, we need to be a resource. We need to be a consultant, a consultancy for other professionals, that we can be on the end of a telephone, that we can sit in meetings, we can sit in multidisciplinary team meetings, so that we can provide the support, the role modelling, the education that our other colleagues in the national health systems needs. We want to provide public support and education. So the new building, the new learning hub, is designed to be an open space where people can come in and look things up, debate. We want local community groups to use it as a venue, very much on the same lines as Premier here, but very much with a focus on enabling conversations about death, dying, aging, loss, etc. And at a societal level, how can we influence through social media, etc.? So I'm just going to say a little bit about what that clinical expertise directed primarily at the complex and unpredictable might look like. Now, this slide, I'm sorry, it's difficult for you to see, but those are our values. And I'll just tell you what the values are, if I can read them. The first one is pioneering and bold. Second is of and for the community. The third is one team working together. The fourth is empowering and compassionate. The fifth is stronger through partnerships. And the sixth, and I think quite the smallest one there, is expert. Because actually, increasingly, we feel we have some expertise, but actually the patient and the family are the real experts. And we also need lots of expertise from our other partners in certainly other conditions. So, and just by the way, these values were developed through focus groups within our organisation. So staff coming together and, you know, actually sharing what they believed were the values of our organisation. So of and for the community, we feel we have corporate responsibility to be a learning hub, which I mentioned before, to think about population health, to engage users, by that I mean our patients, communities, and their carers or relatives. We need also to continually think about, because we're a charity, we have to look at risk, because if we radically change our model from the traditional model, will people still want to support us? Will they still want to give their money? Will they still want to jump out of aeroplanes for this new model? And we need to be continuously collecting reliable data and looking at our clinical performance. So I mentioned last night at the meeting a suite of assessment tools called OAK, which is, we have to continuously think about, are we giving people what they need? And then for pioneering bold and empowering and compassionate, we need to think about leadership. And by that, we don't mean management. We really do mean strong leadership, thinking about our responsibility to be a voice for those that are vulnerable and who are approaching end of life. And not just those in our general community, but what about the homeless, the refugee, the prison population? You know, our National Health Service covers all of those people, and what end of life care and palliative care are they receiving? We have to think about our attitudes and characteristics around our partnerships. So we want to be confident, collaborative, trustworthy, consistent, visible, available, approachable, flexible, coaching, and insightful. So we want to be informed so that we can, and always humble. So actually there's no room for arrogance in this. We're all exploring something which is extremely challenging and emotionally uncomfortable. So what does expert look like? What are our clinical skills? We want levels of competence in clinical reasoning, communication, expert knowledge based on evidence, assessment skills, interventions. So those are really the skills that we're developing in our consultants. So we have a number of consultants. I'm, of course, one of them. But we have clinical consultants that are doctors and nurses. And we have decided that certainly at St. Christopher's, there's very little difference between a doctor and a consultant nurse in their role and responsibilities. That means training people, nurses, up to a level of advanced practitioner and giving them the autonomy and support to work within multidisciplinary teams. And our strategic priorities are very much around driving innovation, empowering the public, maintaining, improving quality, ensuring, extending our reach, which is why I'm here, and ultimately ensuring that we have long-term sustainability. We've survived 50 years. Can we ensure that we survive another 50? So, We are. We decided when we hit our 50th anniversary that we would really rethink everything. And one of the responses to all these challenges was to develop what we're going to call, probably at the moment, the Learning Hub, which will be a new building. It's currently being built. We had to raise the money separate to our service funding for this new building. It's going to have the most high-tech technology. It's going to have lots of flexible spaces. It's going to have clinical skills rooms so that we can bring people in to learn how to turn their mother, do mouth care, communication skills. And it's going to have a very large public space for information and a library and for public meetings. So our approach to facilitating learning is about reflecting our philosophy of care, in which we focus on the goals of individuals seeking our help. So our approach very much to education is asking learners what they're trying to do, and we'll help them to develop the skills and the understanding and to make those attitudinal changes if necessary in order to achieve what they want to achieve. And that is very much our approach. We've moved very much to a rehabilitative model of care, and our approach to training is very much participatory and empowering. So we want learners to articulate what they're wanting to achieve, and be prepared to go back into their organisation and be supported by us to make those changes through action learning. All learning needs to make sense. People have got to understand what difference their training and education will make to patient experience, why it matters, what the consequences of them not changing their behaviours might be. So Quelca, as an example, of our approach. I said more last night. As I said earlier, really focusing on that ambition number five, which is all staff are prepared to care. Now, in English, prepared has two meanings. Prepared as in willing, and prepared as equipped and trained and developed. And so I think it's quite significant that we focus on that and that two, that those different meanings. Certainly, being willing means that those the opportunities we have to speak to undergraduates and to talk to them about the experience of people at end of life. One way of really getting people's attention is to use stories, the stories of people who either haven't received good care and those that have received good care. So increasingly we're using, say that sounds terrible to say we're using, but we are certainly utilising patients and carers. So we have volunteer patients and carers who come and speak to medical students and other learners who come to St. Christopher's. So Quelca is we call it an innovation in end-of-life education. It's not rocket science, and none of the elements are actually new, but it's I think the combination is distinct, and it seems to have an impact. It's about bringing small teams of professionals from one organisation through the programme so that they can go back as a team determined to implement change. And we support them. So Quelca trainers will support a Quelca group over 6 months to embed their changes to their own practice, So their action plan will always apply to themselves, self, team, and organizational change. It was piloted in 2013-14 through with funding from the NHS or Department of Health. And Qualca is always delivered by palliative care practitioners. When it was first designed, there was concern, because I designed it, that I'm an educationalist, I'm also a psychotherapist, but I'm also a palliative care nurse. And there was concern at St. Christopher's that, you know, to deliver the Qualca program, you'd have to have all those qualifications. That is not true. We piloted it initially with an acute trust and a community team. I delivered it to one group, a colleague who had none of those qualifications except she was a palliative care nurse, delivered it to the other group. The impact was exactly the same. The most important attribute of a Qualca trainer is that they are a palliative care clinician, experienced and therefore able to work with learners in a similar way to the way that you would work with patients and families. Compassionate, empathic, person-centered, able to listen, able to not judge, all the attributes of a palliative care clinician. So in summary, it's a 5-day program. Can be delivered in 1 week, or it can, those 5 days could be spread out over a couple of weeks, or maybe three. We suggest no more than that because people tend to have something come up and don't finish. It's really important for them to attend all 5 days, followed by 6 months action learning. There's a combination of classroom reflection, some didactic learning. Primarily day 2 and day 4 have to be out in clinical practice, observing care being delivered. They then have to come back and report to one another what they saw. Not to us as trainers, but to one another. And make sense of that. So we very much use a learning cycle of what, so what, now what. So what did you see? What did you understand? Then so what? How do you make sense of that? How do you understand it? How is it relevant to you? Is there anything here that is important for you to take into your own practice? And then the now what is, what are you going to do with what you've just learnt? As I said, delivered to small teams, no more than 8 people in a group, because it's very important to provide that intimate, safe space where people can really talk about the issues that they're grappling with. It was originally designed for nurses, but can be interdisciplinary or a group of any discipline. Right, I'm going to just try and see whether you can see this film. And we, hopefully you'll be able to hear it. So finally, Qualca is being delivered in various parts of the UK, but we now have international satellites based in China, in South Korea, and Canada. And yesterday afternoon or evening, I was privileged to present the three Qualca trainers from Premier with their certificates. So we now have 3 accredited Qualca trainers here in Sao Paulo. It's now a decision as to whether you want to become a satellite and whether the Qualca would be a useful tool. I do caution that you pilot it, you try it to see whether it fits culturally. But we also have teams in Singapore, Australia, and the Caribbean who are currently thinking about becoming satellites. And I think that is it. Thank you very much.